Tax, drugs and rock and roll, the decade that went whoosh, Brits, hits and Ireland's cultural revolution. It's the story of how an influx of British pop stars in the early 80s was a significant catalyst to the miraculous transformation of Ireland. You thought it was all to do with the Celtic tiger economy as well. Damien Corliss is on the line to explain exactly how it all happened. Damien, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, and thank you for having me.
Now, just playing a bit of Def Leppard. Does it roll back the years for you? Are you now having a shudder at Joe Elliott's hair at that particular time and period in history?
Oh, a poodle perms, yes. God, yeah. The '80s were bad for style. They were bad for music, but they were great for Irish music and Irish style. It's a bizarre, whatever the word is. Conundrum,
that's the word. I was just scrabbling in the grey matter myself for about time. So explain, because, I mean, it was the Gay Byrne show, wasn't it? And he used to go and say, Ireland is Banjax, and it seemed that the island was sort of, it transformed itself from... And I will have people throwing things at the wireless for this one, but Ireland took off in the 80s, and it was nothing to do with you two.
Yeah, I wish. No, if you look at, the period that I've chosen for the book, really, the core period is 1980 to 1995. And if you go back to 1980, Ireland, Dublin, was a backwater. The tourism was way down because of the troubles in the north, overspilling. The economy was in crisis and rubbish. The rivers were polluted. There were no jobs. People were hemorrhaging out of the country to emigrate to Britain, to the States, to Australia. And by 1990, and also Ireland at the start of the 80s was so... conservatively Catholic. And in 1983, we had a referendum banning divorce, even though it was already banned, abortion. Then 1986, divorce. And so I've taken as a pivot of the way the country turned on its head. 1986, Ireland voted overwhelmingly to ban divorce, even though it was already banned. 1995, some 9 short years later, the country approved divorce by popular appeal or acclaim. And the country had undertaken a huge, and this was just before the Celtic Tiger started up. So it was a cultural thing that started first. And my contention is that people from rock stars from Britain had, it's not like they were manning the front lines, and saying change, change, change. Joe Elliott and the rest of them out there picketing, Bord Fáilte. But the first one that appeared, the fact that they were here,
yeah,
was an incredible vote of confidence to young Irish people who had been suppressed and repressed and thrown out of the country by a state that distrusted young people, distrusted youth culture, and really hated jazz from the foundation of the state. And that translates into hating pop music. So into this horrible, horrible situation, Francis Rossi arrived from Status Quo, and he was in a really bad situation as well. His marriage was on the rocks. Status Quo were on the verge of breaking up. They were all fighting with each other. He tells a brilliant story of where my boss, my future boss, in 1978, he brought over my boss, who's the editor of Ireland's only music magazine, to visit Status Quo's recording camp in Germany. And he was walking Niall, who was the Irish rep, through the thing, and this is John, the bass player, and this is the drummer, and Niall was saying, "Hey, this is great. You lot get on so well." And 2 seconds later, they were beating the crap out of each other, the members of Status Quo. So a couple of years later, Francis decided to come to Ireland on a tax year. And that is the operative thing that brought all these people here, tax.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not a case of Francis Russell suddenly waking up one morning and, you know, the light shining down from above and saying, you know, the hand of the Almighty saying, Francis, thou shalt go to Dublin and emancipate the youth. It's a tax break thing, isn't it?
Yeah, like St. Patrick did from, England or Wales or whatever, 1,500 years later, and he got a message from God, go back there and convert those Irish. No, Francis Rossi came for the tax breaks. There were two schemes, and I won't get too technical. One was an Irish tax exemption scheme, where if you stayed here long enough, you could just keep all your money for a create. If you were a writer, Freddie Forsyth was the most famous, Day of the Jackal, the Urgent Safari, blah, blah, blah. He kept all his money. A roaring, you know, patriotic Englishman who just didn't fancy paying his taxes here or there. But so the other one that turned out to be the real draw to Ireland or driver from England was this thing called a 5-year trick. And it meant that if you were earning millions and millions and millions as a rock star or a pop star or whatever, you could stay out of the UK, stay beyond HM customs and revenue for 1 year out of five, and you could amalgamate all your earnings from the 5 years into this 1 year outside of the grasp of HM revenue, and you just kept all your millions and millions and millions. Francis Rossi was the first to pop this, and he arrived in about 1979, 1980. And the thing was, it not only revived his money worries, but it actually, he brought status quo over to Dublin. They discovered this place called Windmill Lane Studios, which is state-of-the-art, world-class, and was only doing trad and folk. And Francis Rossi went in there and said, hey, this is great. And so Status Quo recorded two big albums there, big UK hits. And then hot on their heels, Sting and Andy Summers of The Police arrived. And they were earning far, far. They were on their way. They were already one of the biggest bands in the world, but they were on the way to becoming the biggest band in the world. Sting went out to Galway on the West Coast, had a wonderful time. He loved it, and he would have stayed. Andy Summers, I'll give you a quote from Andy Summers, Andy Summers hated the place. There's a quote here from, instead of the pleasure of popular success we were faced with, the harsh reality of grey weather, bone-chilling damp, biting wind and bad food, and all to beat the tax man. And he wanted to be anywhere else but Ireland. And the thing was, Francis Rossi kept a low profile. Sting and Andy Summers, they tried to actually, you know, have a presence here. And this was proved a bad thing when, during the IRA hunger strikes of 1980-81, and they they were getting threats, you know, so they just got out of the place. And but things, you know, eased back to what passed for normality in that case. So then the next bunch were all these younger bands, because The Police and Status Quo, they predated MTV. MTV started up in 1981 in the States, and The Brits were, I mean, it sparked the second, what became known as the second British invasion of America. And basically, Americans did not understand. They had this brilliant MTV station, which ran 24 hours, demanded videos and videos and videos, and the Americans didn't understand video. So it was up to Duran Duran and Spandau Ballet and Wham and all these, and A Flock of Seagulls became huge in the States on the grounds, not under any musical excellence, but because they actually had the cop to make videos. And so they were MTV stars. So anyway, by 1983, 84, 85, all these newly minted MTV stars, and Def Leppard were the biggest of the lot in sales terms. And they were all sending their accountants around the world saying, you know, we need somewhere to spend a year outside of five for tax purposes. And the Rolling Stones previously had gone to the south of France. Yeah. Rod Stewart famously had settled in LA. But the thing was that Dublin came out best because of the fact that we had our own additional tax savings that they could avail of, and we had Windmill Lane, the best studio in the world. It was a 50-minute flight from London or Sheffield or wherever, and we had, and Joe Elliott and Francis Rossi and various others all said this to me, because I interviewed all these people for the book, and they said, you know, what Ireland had, what Dublin had over the south of France or the Bahamas or LA was that it was everybody spoke English. You could get good fish and chips. The Guinness was great. And it was also, you got Match of the Day and Top of the Pops and all British soaps. And Joe Elliott had this brilliant story whereby he back in the early 80s, the biggest soap in the world was Dallas. And so Joe Elliott would, and RTE, the Irish TV, broadcast episodes of Dallas weeks and sometimes a couple of months ahead of the BBC. So what Joe Elliott would do was he'd get all the advance episodes taped off Irish television, and then he'd send them home to his mother in Sheffield, and she would invite all her friends around, and she was just, you know, king of the hill.
The most popular woman in Sheffield.
Absolutely. They had all the plots, you know, sussed, you know, weeks in advance. But there was more than that, because Ireland and Britain, since independence, since Irish independence, we shared what's called the common travel area. We still share it, which meant that you could travel. The thing was, all these people were supposed to be out of the country, you know, strictly speaking. But because there was, and, you know, they all admitted to this, that this was a part of the attraction. Because there was no passport exchange, if you wanted to go home and have, you know, beer with your mates in down the pub in Leeds or whatever, or, you know, visit your folks in London or whatever, you just hopped on a plane. Nobody was checking anything, and, you know, you were just back whenever you fancied it. And they loved this. This was manna from heaven, you know.
So, I mean, and this is the one that blew my tiny mind, are things like, because we say that sort of Sting's out there, you can see him wandering, can't you, in a long coat, looking over the wild Atlantic coast, you know, getting feeling very spiritual, and Andy Summers is sort of shivering and muttering. But it's the people like, you know, Frankie Goes to Hollywood and Spandau Ballet getting involved in the community, and was it judging beauty contests or something?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is brilliant. I mean, Joe Elliott, Spandau would where heavily involved in judging beauty contests.
Wonder why.
Yeah, but the thing was, they were going out, you know, they were, you'd think that they'd be living in their gated mansions and estates or whatever. They were going out to judge beauty contests in the roughest parts of Dublin. And Joe Elliott actually met his future wife on one of these judging panels. Now, they were both judges. It wasn't some woman that he saw, you know, and said, oh, fancy that.
Yeah.
But there was also, I mean, the first to arrive of all those MTV stars, and they're sort of largely forgotten now, but they played Live Aid in Philadelphia, and they were the Thompson Twins. And they, amongst others, just talked about the wonderful, and they did try to, they came for solitude and to, you know, write and to get away from the world and the carnival of fame and all this. But they ended up being drawn into village life. And Tom Bailey was telling me, the singer, was telling me of one incident where they were invited to go down and visit the local kids' youth club or whatever. And they said, oh, well, we know what they expect here. So they dressed up in all their outsized Top of the Pops gear.
Right.
and stuff like that. And they went down to the youth club, and the kids and the scoutmasters were having none of this. They said, oh, hey, great, you're here. Let's go and play a game of rounders. And they were completely inappropriately trapped. But Holly Johnson, I mean, the other, there were five members of Frankie's, Holly Johnson, the singer, was the one that actually did want a quiet life down in Boris. The Thompson twins handed over Boris House, a huge mansion, country house in rural Ireland, to the Frankie's. Holly Johnson got totally into this rural life or whatever, village life. And then, the other four, they were just mad up for clubbing in Dublin with Spandau Ballet and Def Leppard. Holly Johnson was telling me this brilliant story where he got friendly with this elderly woman who ran a pottery shop in this little village close to where they lived. And she told him one day that she was going to have to close the shop the next day because she had an appointment in Dublin. And he said, "Hey, that's okay. Leave it with me and we'll man your shop." So at the height of their fame, global fame, these mad, and they were known for their mad lifestyles, Frankie goes to Hollywood for one full day. They opened and ran a pottery shop in this little quiet village. And of course, word went around to all the kids that, quickly there were big queues outside the pottery shop, looking for autographs. And it got to the point where they said, okay, no more autographs unless you buy something. So they sold out entirely of egg cups, which were the cheapest thing that were for sale there.
Oh, brilliant. And of course, I mean, now Dublin is obviously hip and happening and, you know, you can't move for boutique hotels, et cetera, Temple Bar. But so I suppose back in the day, it revitalised it. And also, there are very few nightclubs. Isn't it true that the main nightclub in Dublin had more celebrities per square metre than, say, Studio 54 or Stringfellows?
Well, that's what the New York Times claimed at the time. And I mean, it's probably an exaggeration, but I mean, on a given night, you might have, I mean, you know, David Bowie went there, Mick Jagger went there, U2 were regulars, Def Leppard, Spandau Ballet, the Frankies, they lived there, basically, you know. So for a period, Ronnie Wood of the Rolling Stones, who came in on the tail of all those people, and have famous parties just outside in his place, just outside Dublin. I mean, Ronnie Wood was he was the king of the pool tables in the Pink Elephant. Ronnie had this great story as well about, one was about an argument between Keith Richards and Jerry Lee Lewis in his back garden. And I'm not sure who won that or if it was a draw. But he also said that Bob Dylan got up from dinner at one point during one of his famous parties there and put on his overcoat and just walked around the back garden in mud, in wellies in mud. Ronnie was saying, to look at him, he probably thought that he was walking down Madison Avenue or whatever. But it was a crazy time. And the thing was, they did, I mean, there was, where they did actually, it all came, I was at this game and it was just prior to the World Cup, the famous Hand of God World Cup of 1986. And, there was a charity celebrity football match between Dermot Morgan's Irish Showbiz 11. I mean, Dermot Morgan back in 1986, about 9 years before Father Ted just went mad. But Dermot Morgan was already very famous in Ireland and notorious. So Dermot Morgan's 11 played a team of Def Leppard and Spandau Ballet and the Frankies, and it just, you know, on just this little, and you know, with three men and a dog, basically, looking on.
And I suppose the thing is that they weren't in that there London, so therefore they were more approachable. And you could, you know, as a writer, as a journalist, it must have been brilliant because you could actually sort of hang out with them rather than within the UK. There would be press people and paparazzi and all that sort of thing.
Yeah. You could hang out. I mean, I played football with them. I played kick-arounds with them. And you could talk to them in the nightclubs. You wouldn't really stop them on the street. I mean, because the Irish people were just too cool for school, basically, when it came to the rock stars. At this stage, they were used to passing by, you know, Joe Elliott or Phil Lynott or Bono or whatever, just walking down the street beyond them. And so the Irish people had this thing that, now maybe things have changed slightly because this was pre-selfies, and I don't know how selfies have affected that whole dynamic. But
well, we only have to look at the portal, don't we, between Dublin and New York and what's happened there.
Yeah. But, Francis Rossi was telling me that one of the great things about living here was that people knew, and Carol King said this to me as well. She lived here for a load of time, and I spent some time with her. Lovely woman. But I don't think she even came from the tax, because when she started living here in the early to mid-90s, the MTV generation had transformed the place so much that people, rock stars were just, and pop stars were just coming here because it was hip. I mean, and that's why I'm saying it was their contribution pre the Celtic Tiger was a cultural thing, but it sort of laid some of the ground for it. But Francis Rossi had a great quote where he said, because he was splitting his time between Drumoland Castle down in County Clare, very rural, and Jury's Hotel, which is in the centre of Dublin, very cosmopolitan and busy. And he said, in Dublin, people would know who you were, and they wouldn't even acknowledge it. They wouldn't even nod at you. They'd just walk past. And they might look back to see him walking and, you know, oh, that was him. Yeah, yeah. But he was saying it was exactly the opposite, that he'd be wandering around the Bohareens and laneways of County Clare. And he said, you'd be just walking along and this complete stranger, a farmer or a milkman or whatever, would just be passing you by, and they'd stop you and they'd want to talk. And he said this was actually really great because, you know, they didn't, in general, they didn't know who you were at all. They were just interested in talking to you. And he was saying, you know, here I was, this big, tall hippie with lanky hair and denim, and all these just ordinary people, they didn't see that. They just wanted to talk to you and say, how's it going? You know, are you having a good day? And he said, the only thing was, he said, nobody wanted to shag you, but that was grand.
How much fun was it putting this book together then?
It was great fun. It was just great fun because I lived through it. I mean, this thing, Dublin is such a village that I was in a band, say, 1982, 1983 or whatever, and I was still living at home with my folks, and just a grey suburb of North Dublin in the city, just anonymous and grey, except that Bono lived around the corner. But he was living in the same grey suburb, whatever. But they built an extension onto the road, and the singer in my band moved in. So it was about 300 metres down the road, and he moved into one of the new houses there. And every time we met, he said, Francis Rossi is living across the road from me. Francis Rossi is living across the road from me. He stands out in the back garden, or in the front garden, and has a smoke and stuff like that. And we were all saying to him, Emmett, please, would you just cop on? There's a hippie with lank hair and denim, and he's living and in a three-bed semi-D on this anonymous estate across the road from you. And I was telling this to Francis Rossi just as we finished off our interview for the book. And he said, oh, yeah, that was me. So Bonsi for years was living on my road. This completely anonymous thing, but Dublin is just it's a village, you know.
What do you hope that people will take from this? Because it's just so brilliantly surreal, isn't it? The whole situation, and absolutely fabulous.
Yeah. It was a special time, and things have changed because it's like with politicians that in the same period that I cover. In the 1980s, Irish politicians, they would say the most outrageous things because it had not been coached out of them by their spin doctors and their, you know, educators and people saying, you cannot say that, you cannot say that. And now they don't say it anymore. And you know, the world is less colourful for the fact that they don't say these mad things. We need to look to Donald Trump for that now. But it's the same with rock stars that you still see them, you know, on the street or whatever. I mean, I remember it could have been 10 years ago, but it was recent enough. And again, it was the same thing as usual. And just walking down Grafton Street, one of the main streets in Dublin, and Tom York of Radiohead is just walking past me the other way. And he's not looking at anybody. Nobody's looking at him. Except everybody knows that it's Tom York. But, you know, so it still happens. And people feel, and again, it's like Carole King said, you know, to me, she said, the great thing about Dublin is that, you know, it's because she's a New Yorker, and she said, Dublin is a capital city. It's like New York, but it's walkable. You don't need a car to get around. And if people see her, they don't stop her. They don't even acknowledge her.
The book is called Tax, Drugs and Rock and Roll. Damien, if people want to find you online, is there a website? Where can they get you? Where can they find you the nicest possible way?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm on Facebook, so that's the simplest thing to do.
Super. And the book's going to be available to order via our own virtual bookstore. I could have talked to you about this all day, but I'm going to run out of time and crash the news. The book is called Tax, Drugs and Rock and Roll. It's by Damien Corliss. Order it via the TRE virtual bookstore. Damien, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Giles.